Hiya and welcome to episode 20 of Better Off Red. Today in this episode I am talking to my friend and amazing writer Natasha Dennerstein. She Skyped in from San Francisco. I sat in the damp in the cold of Wellington and she called from the sunny, it never rains in California, of San Francisco, and we had a great chat about Jeff Cochran's The Bengal Engine's Mango Afterglow, which is a magnificent collection of poetry. I always feel weird calling it a collection. Jeff's books always seem like a complete journey in a way. Oh, that's a dreadful word. But there's something magnificent about how the poems talk to each other and sit together in any of Jeff's books. So yeah, we had a great chat about that. I've put some links up on the website. Jeff's poetry and his fiction is published mainly by Victoria University Press. So I've put some links up to there. Our website is betterrednz.wordpress.com. So that's betterred and it's readnz.wordpress.com. We're also on Facebook. I just realised that I'd never tell you that. We're on Facebook at Better Off Red and we're also on Twitter at BetterRedNZ. So, yeah, you can get hold of us at any of those places. My conversation with Natasha just fired me up more about Jeff's work. I just got more excited, which is, you know, if you know me, it's hard to do because I'm pretty excited about Jeff Cochran's work anytime. But yeah, we had a great chat and I hope you enjoy it. And thank you very much for listening. Okay, so I am sitting in Wellington and it is raining. And Natasha, where are you?
I'm in San Francisco and it's summertime. It's going to be the 4th of July, which is a big holiday here, and it's just been Pride here, and the sun came out right on cue for Pride weekend, and it's actually been quite hot in the daytime, so it's high summer.
High summer. We're just dank. I think it's just horrible here. Did you have a celebration around your area at the marriage equality decision coming through?
Not my area, Pip. I live in an area called The Mission, which is very much a Mexican-American area with other Latino people, San Salvadorians, Spanish-speaking neighborhood where I live. So it's not Pride isn't a big thing here, but whereas other things like Day of the Dead are huge here. But in the next neighborhood, which is the Castro, that's the LGBT heartland, there was all celebrations and marches and street things and people really and allies, not just queer people, but as you know, allies. The whole city celebrates, you know.
Oh, it's just so great, so great. I was just looking at the cover. We're going to talk about Jeff Cochran's "The Bengal Engine's Mango Afterglow." Best title ever. Right. And I was just looking at the cover and it looks a bit Day of the Dead-y, my version. It's kind of all, you know, beautiful, rich, warm colours and black and it's just wonderful. That's the one, yeah.
It's pink and orange. It's a very good graphic. It's kind of 1970s, isn't it? The lettering and the... Yeah.
It's really gorgeous. It's really gorgeous. So this came out in 2012, I think. I'm just going to check my... Oh, yes, 2012. And I think that there has been, oh, gosh, two or three books since this one. But I'm particularly fond of this one. I was wondering, can you remember where you were when it came out?
Yeah, I was in Wellington. I think that must have been the year I was at Vic Uni doing my master's. Or maybe perhaps it was the year after. It was around that time. I actually met Jeff Cochran that year. I think he came as a guest speaker or reader to the IIML that year. I could be wrong though, but I have met him and we had a nice conversation. Mm. And I'm a huge admirer of him as a poet.
What is it about his work that you like?
Oh, Pip, I just think, you know, I love his sonic qualities. I love how he kind of flips words around and reverses them around vowels and consonants. He's very much sort of wordplay. And also he is quite brave. You know, he as themes, he takes subjects that perhaps other poets wouldn't, you know, about his own health and about people's, you know, fears about themselves. And, you know, he's a very honest poet and also a highly literate poet.
I was just looking through this and I was amazed. Like, obviously there's the Basho poems. Oh, is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah.
Yeah. And, but I was looking through and like, Ginsberg's in here, which always makes me think of you. And, you know, like, it's just, and even like, Henry James is in here, but in the same vein, so is Peter Jackson and David Lean. And yeah.
And so is Michael Ondaatje. And if I remember rightly, could be Gertrude Stein. And you know what else he does? I don't know if you noticed, I'm sure you probably would have, is that he references other poets, not by name, but by word plays on titles of their books and of using characters that are in their books, you know, and sort of obliquely references other authors.
Yeah, that's one of the joys I have with reading his work, is that kind of, I don't like that word layering, because that makes it sound sort of kind of pragmatic or something, but it just feels like an immersion in, I don't know, like that idea of an ocean of work, you know, it just feels like this immersion in a mind that's read and kind of thought, and yeah, I really love it.
Yeah, but Pip, the way you describe it, you make him sound very academic and sort of with a lot of discipline about his referencing and allusions and drawing threads together. I think it's a much more relaxed thing. I think he's open in the mind, and all of these things come into his mind, and he just sort of, you know, pours them onto the paper.
Yeah,
I think that there's a free aspect to it.
I think that's so true, isn't it? Yeah, because it really does. I don't know much about Jeff or his life, but I do know that he writes every day, and I feel like this kind of feels like the work of someone. It feels like a continuous work. It feels like a work immersed in a life in some way, maybe.
Yeah. What did you think of the those pink sheets that are interspersed throughout it, which are sort of like jottings or, just notes or something like that?
I really enjoyed them. I can't remember. I actually wrote a review of this book, which no one would publish in the end. Someone asked me to write the review, and then I wrote the review and they didn't want to publish it.
So I reviewed it for two, Pip.
You reviewed it for the listener, though, didn't you?
No, I didn't. I reviewed it for the New Zealand Poetry Society, for Loris Gilbert, who's the editor there. And that appeared in the New Zealand Poetry Society's journal, online journal called A Fine Line. And then I think it was Helen Heath, who we both know, who was working for Victoria University Press at the time, and I think she used a segment of my review on the VUP website.
Awesome. I'll link to that. Because, yeah, I think those pink sheets are so exciting for me. Like, I remember they sent me, because I, you know, like I am really, you know, I get all, I don't know what the word is, analytical and stuff. And it sent me trying to work out what a pink sheet was. And I always think of pink sheets that are additions to a script, you know, like when I was working in TV, the new pages that had been thought up the night before would come. I'm sure there's a way more technical way of doing it. And they would sort of sit in. And that's how I sort of thought of these, is these awesome kind of like a series. I don't know. What did you make of them?
I thought that they were just jottings or fragments of thoughts that he's collected in some kind of journal and then sort of somehow gathered and presented in some kind of manner. And I think that whoever edited the book, it could have been Fergus Barrowman. I know he's edited others of Jeff's work, but whoever's edited it, I feel, has intersperse these pink sheets amongst other poems in a way that's very satisfying.
Yeah, I agree. I was just looking, like, pink sheet 2 and 3 follow each other, and I must say that's something I really enjoy about this book, is that thing you were talking about where there isn't, just when you think there's a rhythm, or not a rhythm, that's the wrong word, but just when you think there's a pattern, you know, like you know, there's going to be a pink sheet every 10 pages or something, they play with that and kind of mess it up a little bit. And I totally agree. It's extremely satisfying the way that happens.
Do you think that Jeff has made these decisions, or do you think that this is the result of a very clever editor?
I have no idea. Like, I really don't know, because I must say that is something that blows me away about this book, is that there is something as a because I write, you know, prose and fiction rather than writing poetry. I am just in awe of the narrative structure of this book, which I know is not probably the right way to think about it, but the rhythm of it and the noise that it makes as it goes through, like the noise of one poem kind of skipping on to the next. It just seems so perfect and so fulfilling, but not in a narrative arc way or in a, you know, like neatly, you know, curated way. There's something about it that just, we just roll, and sometimes we're pushed into the next poem, sometimes we fall into it, sometimes it's just, yeah, I really love it. What do you think? What's your experience? Because you've edited poetry collections while you've been over there and stuff, eh? Like, you've been...
Yeah, I have. I think I've got a newfound respect for a good poetry editor. I think that the way that the poems are splayed is a very skillful thing if it's done well.
I totally agree. Because I think it's that strange thing where, you know, like when you think about the container that you decide to put a collection of poems into, you know, like a poem seems often so complete by itself, and you know, I've read poems from this collection, you know, in other places, and you know, that's a satisfying experience. But there's something interesting about the decision, especially with a writer like Jeff, who's writing all the time, to say this is a book now. And like you say, I think an editor is just, you know, that there's a definite kind of genius that happens with you know, poetry editing.
I think so.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have got this tendency, Pip, in my own writing to be a bit regimented. Like, for example, I'm writing a poetry about the human body, and I want to group it all together, you know, poems about skin, poems about bones. I don't have the ability to be totally free form. I need to write to some kind of pattern for some reason. I'd love to be able to let go of that.
Yeah, I think I'm very similar as well. Like, I'm very neaty, tidy. And, like, I mean, it's one of the things that I've been trying really hard this year to let go of some of that. And it's really
because
interesting.
We want to control the world, Pip. We want to control the world. But I think Jeff Cochrane likes the chaos. I think he gets on the chaos.
I think you're so right. I think, yeah, it's definitely about control for me. It's definitely about control. Like, you know, nothing, you know, that thing where I kind of feel like, you know, we're William Brent and I are teaching in the prison a lot, and I know that you've got background working in prisons and stuff like that as well. And I must admit that when we put our proposals forward, we're often saying that, you know, that, you know, a writer does get to control a world that maybe they haven't had control of outside, you know, like it is like we can make decisions and make the outcomes of those decisions come out better or worse. And I wonder if that's just an extension of that. So what do you want to talk a little bit? I'd love to hear, like, I mean, I sort of know what you're up to, but I'm sure people would love to hear what you're doing in San Francisco. Like,
I am doing an MFA in poetry at the San Francisco State University in the creative writing department, and an MFA in the States. It's between an MA and a PhD, but it's very practical and grounded in actual, you know, writing and studies around writing and literature and stuff. So it's not, it really is like a sort of an in-between phase between a master's and a PhD. And it's quite common here. A lot of people do MFAs after graduating. So, and I'm specializing in poetry, and it's a great school. And I'm doing some really interesting stuff, like editing work on magazines and the craft of translation and stuff about the nexus between visual art and poetry, some very interesting things.
Because, I mean, you have got amazing experience in all those things. Like, I know that when you were living in Wellington, I know, like, you were doing work with Indonesian language, you were doing work with the visual artist. What's the name of the visual artist that you work with in Australia?
Oh, yeah, that's Kay Freeman, a painter.
She does beautiful work. Because that's, I think your poems in response to some of her work were some of the first of those body poems that I read. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. Yes, yes, it is. In fact, how that whole project started was Kay contacted me and said, oh, Natasha, you know about poetry. I love poetry and it really helps me with my painting. But I'm looking for poems about skulls.
Awesome.
And can you recommend any for me? And I came up with a couple, and she said, oh, they're great. Anything else? And I said, oh, I don't know. Why don't I write you one? She said, oh, would you? I said, yeah, skulls. You know, it's kind of, you know, I was thinking skull and crossbones, skull. And then the poem I wrote her was kind of like an imagined stripping down of my own head to show this infrastructure. And I started thinking of the skull as the infrastructure of the intelligence, the container that contains the brain. And I sort of went off on a track with that, and I was very excited by that, and sort of that project developed into a whole lot of other poems and paintings that went with poems and stuff like that.
Because I was just thinking, you're in a really interesting position, because like when I knew you in Wellington, you were working as a psychiatric nurse, and I was just thinking that combination of the very kind of physical work of nursing, you know, like the stitching people up and blood, you know, blood and guts and that sort of thing, coupled with, you know, the nature of nursing someone's mind, you know, it's that poem, the idea of the skull as the container and those sort of interfaces of sort of, you know, like, you know, physiology and whatever the mind is sort of stuff.
Well, I'm very interested in the body as container, and I think of it as a bag of skin, of skin, like a purse that we carry around, a sort of this clattering collection of bones and organs and things. It's a container.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I mean, I think that's what's interesting about Jeff's work, is that there's a lot of physicality in there as well. Like, I was just thinking about, I always think of the worm and the tequila. I always think of that as the diabetes collection, which is probably cruel. But I don't know. That idea of body and mind in poetry is so intriguing, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And I think that Jeff, he does focus on his own physical ailments quite a lot, and also on his drinking and or, you know, sobriety or cessation of drinking. It's all through all of his work, that issue. To my mind, those are the less successful poems. You know, I prefer other poems that are a bit more out there than that.
Yeah, it's quite cool, eh? Like, I think I love that about literature, is that, you know, that it just keeps pushing and pushing and getting bigger and bigger, it feels like. What sort of, I saw a fantastic video of you performing with a jazz band, and I liked what you were saying before about how you like the sort of, was that oral? I can't remember the word you used, but you like the
Sonic.
And you were talking about the sonic value of Jeff Cochran. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the experience of reading with live music. Like, that's something we don't see a lot of in New Zealand, eh?
Yeah, well, I sort of I fell into a group of people that are sort of on the intersection between poetry for the page and poetry for the stage. You know, they're quite literate poets, but they're also performance poets. So it's sort of, you know, on the one end you've got slam or rap, and on the other end you've got very academic, dry kind of poetry. And this sort of collection of people that I found are kind of in the middle. And I like that. I think I've found where I belong on the spectrum.
That's so cool, eh? Like, because I think, like, I mean, I have had immense enjoyment of your work on the page. Like, I love reading it. But I also think that you're a fantastic performer as well. Did the drive come, like, did both those things kind of arrive together? Or did you think, I'm going to write for the page and then have to read somewhere and then think, oh, quite like this as well? Or do you hear a poem when you write it? Or
you know, it's exactly like you said. I started writing for the page and reluctantly performed those poems, and then I kind of enjoyed it, and then the sort of performance became another aspect to it. And then now that I've joined this group called Word Party, and you know, I perform with them quite a lot. There's a three-piece band, bongo drums, saxophone and double bass.
Awesome.
It's great. Yeah. And we interact and they play off against us. And I trust those musicians. So when I start with my rhythm, they come in and join my rhythm. And then sometimes they'll race ahead and I'll join up with them. I can slow them down with my voice, or, you know, they're responsive. It's a conversation. Really like it.
That must just be incredible.
Yeah, I've found myself now writing pieces particularly for performing with music, and they tend to have more end rhyme and they tend to be more rhythmic, you know, because they perform well.
Yeah.
They've got a music quality about them. So they don't look so good on the page, those pieces, but people love them.
Oh man, I really enjoyed, like, I've always enjoyed your performance, but that music was just something, it was an absolute revelation to me, because it was the clip that I saw, the jazz was very free behind you. Like, it wasn't like sort of like drums reinforced, you know, because I listen to a lot of hip hop and rap, I always think of a very, you know, like regular rhythm, but like your work just, it was really, you could really feel the improvisation in it.
Yeah, oh, great. Good.
So good.
Good. Do you know, when I first came to the States, I was kind of nervous and I thought, you know, people might find me funny because I've got an Australian accent, and I was very nervous about criticizing American society, you know, because I wrote a poem about homeless people, because I was very moved and dismayed by the number of homeless people here in this city, and I was too nervous to read it because I thought people will think, oh, who's that Australian woman criticizing America? She should go home. She's a dingo fucker. But that nobody was like that. They said, oh, you're great, honey. You know, they love the way I speak and they love accents, and they, particularly poets, they love anyone that's criticizing society, or, you know, I've done a lot of kind of satiric poems too that have gone down very well. So I've lost that fear now of being, you know, considered an outsider with no rights. You know, I've lost that fear.
Going down.
Pink sheet number 8. Keith Moon died of a heminurine overdose. O minstrel galleons of Carib fire, half an aneurin molecule, hemi plus aneurin, found to prevent convulsions in epileptic rats, used to sedate alcoholics withdrawing from alcohol, no longer manufactured, alas. The frequent brutality of our teachers, nuns and Marist brothers, was also a sort of mock brutality. The seal's wide spindrift gaze toward paradise. Do you know, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, amongst those, interspersed amongst his discussion about heminurin, which is, as he said, a drug used to prevent seizures, he's got, those are quotes are from Hart Crane, an American poet, "O Minstrel Galleons of Carib Fire." And I thought, when I first read it, I thought it was kind of arbitrary. He's just put lines of poetry in there which are incredibly lyrically beautiful. But then quite some months later, a couple of things fell into place for me. And I thought, oh, Hart Crane was an alcoholic and he committed suicide in 1933 by jumping off the back of a boat. He was on a cruise to Mexico. And so he died young. He was a troubled person. He had was a very heavy drinker and committed suicide. So that's the connection between the drinking, the alcoholism, the overdose, the heminurin. You know, it's quite clever.
And Keith Richards is in there as well, isn't he?
I don't know. I can't remember. It wouldn't surprise me.
Because I was just thinking that weird combination in there that you do get between, you know, like things that have found their way into the canon and things that are sort of still maybe, maybe not. I don't know. Like, I really love the contemporary nature of a lot of the poems for sure. Hart Crane wrote an amazing poem which I looked at. I'm sure it's to the Brooklyn Bridge. I'll be an idiot now and not know which one. It's to a bridge and it's the most beautiful poem. It's just, it's like this, oh, it's just lovely. He's just wonderful.
I'm sure it's not Walt Whitman.
Ah, probably. You know me, Natasha. I never know anything that I'm talking about.
I'm sure Hart Crane wrote a collection called White Buildings, and it might be in that one.
Maybe it is, I'm not sure. Oh, crazy.
But I get him confused with Stephen Crane, who's another poet, but from, you know, earlier time, from 1870 to 1900.
Awesome. Because you're living in all amongst that at the moment, eh? Like, I was in San Francisco a long time ago, maybe 2 or 3 years ago, and I remember just feeling a very real sense, like with City Lights Bookstore, with, you know, like just that walking the streets, you know, it feels very alive in a way. Yeah, it's really beautiful there. What's it like living in San Francisco?
Oh, well, it's great. It's really good. As a writer, there is an enormous amount of writing history associated with this city, you know, places named after Mark Twain, who lived here, and Armistead Maupin lives here and has set all of his stories in San Francisco and is always around and about the place. And we've even got streets and laneways named after Jack Kerouac. There's Jack Kerouac Way. Yeah, which is really lovely.
And that's, I mean, like, Jeff famously sort of sticks pretty close to home. Like,
he's never left New Zealand, apparently.
No. And I was just wondering, what's it like for you? Like, you're Australian born, eh? And then yes. New Zealand for a lot, you know, Nelson and Wellington and now San Francisco. What do you think that, and you've spent a lot of time in Indonesia as well. Like, what does that give you? What does that movement bring to your poetry, do you think?
I have always felt a bit stateless. And I think it's because of having a Jewish background. My grandparents were immigrants from Eastern Europe, Belarus and Russia, or what's now Belarus. And so growing up, you know, my family had spoke with accents and we were never sort of accepted in the white Australia model. We were always kind of immigrants, even though I was born there, you know. And so I think for that reason, I never felt like You know, I always felt like a foreigner in Australia. Then when I came to New Zealand, you know, there's a lot of stuff about cultural identity in New Zealand and who belongs and who doesn't. And as a foreigner, I felt that I had a privileged position, really, because I didn't have to claim to be a New Zealander, you know? And I'm aware of Maori people and how it actually is their country. And I've always had this idea of myself as being an honoured guest. And if I was polite and respectful towards people and demonstrated, you know, that I knew my place, they would treat me with respect. And they have, and they did. And I think it's, you know, I was in an enviable position, you know, being a white foreigner, but not having to claim to, you know, I don't know. I was sort of above, or not above, but aside from that debate.
Yeah.
And, you know, I did a lot of thinking when I was there, Pip, and like, you know, who am I? Where do I belong? What piece of this earth can I say is mine? And I came to the conclusion that I don't give a fuck because I think that that's all the trouble that there is in the world, you know, is about I'm from here and you're from there and disputed territories and who belongs more than others and who's an import and who's an original and how original is original. And the poetry and the writing of ethnic origins and ethnicity and nationality and nationalism bores me. Mm. And that's kind of why I went to the body, you know, because we've all got one, right? So I wanted to write about stuff that not transcends, but that's aside from that debate. And the last thing I wanted to write was, you know, poems about place and the fauna and flora of that place. I mean, that's fine for others, and I appreciate people that do write along those lines, but it's not for me. You know, I'm a stateless poet in some ways.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I mean, that's often what I find with Jeff's poetry as well, is there's that odd thing where, you know, he hasn't left here in a lot of ways, but also there's that strange thing where he seems so un-New Zealand in a lot of, I don't know what that means. I mean, that's a problematic term in itself. What does that mean?
No, he does. He seems international. And I think because he travels in his mind.
Yes. Yeah.
And I think he's probably connected with people from other places. He sets things in Paris and Spain and, you know, because he's obviously really, really well read. Mm. And, you know, he inhabits the world in his imagination.
Mm.
And I don't think he's not trying to be international, but I think that he's carved out that place for himself of internationalism.
I think you're dead right. You mentioned that you're doing some academic work on, it sounds very artistic work actually, on translation and poetry.
Yeah.
And that is another thing I always think of when I think of you, is that your incredible range of languages. Like, I often we'd be having a conversation and you'd say to me, oh, do you know what the Russian word for that is? Do you know what this is? Or here's some Yiddish. And I just really, really love that about you. And I'm wondering, in the same way that I asked you, what does the travelling bring to your poetry? What does that, you know, because was English the first language that was spoken in your home?
Yes, but my grandparents spoke Russian and Polish, Hebrew and Yiddish. So I grew up with all mixtures of all of these languages.
Yeah.
And my mother studied French and loved French and was fluent in French, you know, even though she was born in Australia. So, you know, I grew up in a polyglot or a multi-language environment.
And what are some of the things about translating poetry or using different language in poetry as opposed to perhaps, I don't know, translating a novel or a short story or something like that. Do you have any ideas about that or any views on that?
Do you think I do?
I think you do. I hope you do.
I think you're right. I think you're right. I do have views, and I see it as the difference between transliteration and translating a poem, in which you don't only translate the words, but you translate the poetics of the piece. So I think that there can be combinations of the two, sometimes very literal transliterations of poems where they, word for word, it's basically rendered in, from one language into another. Sometimes that's good because people want the translator to be true to the artist and not try and improve upon the artist or whatever. But then there are other translators that really try to capture the poetic tone and style of the writer from one language and render an approximation of it in the other language that they're translating into. And I find that much more interesting.
Yeah. God, that must be amazing. And I think it's really interesting. I think, have you got a short story in the new Phantom Coffee Reader?
Yeah.
Because that's I've been lucky enough to read a bit of your fiction as well, and I just wonder that's obviously something you've written recently, the short story.
I actually wrote it in the wake of Amy Winehouse dying.
Yeah.
Whenever that was.
Because because I love your fiction, but I love your poetry as well, I always get frightened that you won't come back to the dark side of fiction. So I was very happy to read that short story. And I'm just wondering, do you still... you don't seem like the sort of person that would cut off a possibility, but where does your fiction writing sit at the moment with everything else?
It seems to me that the trend in contemporary writing is to be hybrid genre and cross genre, and my department where I'm at really encourages people not to box themselves in as saying, I only do nonfiction or I only do poetry, and to encourage people to take classes in other disciplines and also to combine disciplines. And there's people are doing really interesting stuff. They're doing nonfiction in verse. They're doing hybrid biographies. They're doing fictionalized accounts of nonfiction material. It seems to be that the trend is to throw the rules out the window in some ways, in terms of genre and what have you. And I actually quite like that. And I've been experimenting a bit of writing nonfiction, actually.
Wow, that's incredible. That's exciting for me as a reader of your work.
Yeah.
I think you're so right. I think that there is something really compelling about that idea of not being hedged in like that.
Yeah. I've my eyes have opened up quite a bit since I've been there, and I've found out that I'm not bad at nonfiction. And I kind of, well, what I'm doing is I'm using some of the discipline from poetry, some of the lyrical language, the sonic play of poetry into the nonfiction. And I find that really exciting to do that.
I just find that really compelling, because I guess then you've got constraints on both sides, haven't you? Because I know, like that thing with nonfiction, that the inability to make something up is quite exciting about it as a form. You know, the sort of slight bindiness that puts on you, it sort of ties you up in a way that is so interesting to me. Have you got anything there you could read from recent times?
Of nonfiction.
Well, anything. What would you like? Have you got anything you'd be willing to read us?
Oh, sure.
Oh, yay.
Like, I would like to read you this poem called House of Sticks. House of Sticks. I'm just going to find it because it's one of my San Francisco poems, which I felt, I was funny about. I felt was very reluctant to read it because I thought it could be, it's got a, I'll just read it. And you'll see. Sorry, I'm trying to bring it up on my screen as we're talking. House of Sticks, House of Sticks. Where are you? Here we go. I've got a little box with your face in it, and then middle of the poem.
Get rid of Pip. That would be a good thing. How about I turn off the video? That might fix it.
Oh, yes. Yes, do.
Does that work?
Yes. Okay, House of Sticks. Yes, I'm lying on a flattened box outside the BART, handled with care, product of Vietnam, this way up. They call me homeless, but I like to think of it as electively residential, address-free. Yes, my legs are mighty swollen, pitting edema / compartment syndrome, not elephantiasis caused by a worm in Africa. I learnt about that when I worked in admin at the county hospital. That was before I got laid off. That was before I got a bad credit score, before my boy Mikey got himself killed in Afghanistan, and before my husband hung himself in the garage one Tuesday afternoon in bare feet and his suit and tie. One minute I'm working at County Hospital, the next I'm a patient on a gurney, the dirty lady in curtain 7. I can't afford any shame. I built myself up on a scaffolding of grade score, average, and credit rating illusion, but those stats don't mean jack. Those stats are cotton candy sitting on top of a house of sticks. Pull one out at the bottom and the whole damn thing comes tumbling down. House of sticks, house of sticks. The whole damn thing's just a house of sticks. I don't need your pity. You can put it back in your organic cotton backpack, honey. I've busted out of this house of sticks. I'm going to spread my wings and take off and soar over this city, shit over Knob Hill, float out to Marin County on warm undercurrents. I'm going to be free as a fucking bird. And that's it.
Oh, Natasha, that is magnificent.
Thank you.
I love the way, I love the way you keep poking at the metaphor, you know what I mean? Like, it would, yeah. You know, a lesser poet would have gone, oh yeah, that's, there we go, we made that point. It's just beautiful. Like, it just, oh god, and the rhythm's so good, and oh, I love it. God, you're a good poet.
You know, I think, you know, there's so much homelessness here. Outrageous numbers of people sleep on the streets and what have you. I mean, I know they do in Wellington too, but there seems to be, I think we've got 7,000 homeless in San Francisco City.
And you've been doing some work at the soup kitchen, eh?
Yeah, I have. But I think, you know, I have this idea that you never know why and how someone has become homeless. Mm. And you know, it could happen to you or I easily. You know, you just have to, you know, lose the loved ones in your life, lose your financial structure, you know, not be able to pay your mortgage, become unemployed. You know, it's easy to take one person that seems so stable and to just knock out everything, and then, you know, before you know it, you're living on the streets.
I think that's so true. Like, I know, I know when I was there, it was something that people told me to anticipate, but when I got there, nothing could have really prepared me for it, you know, and exactly that thing where I just kept seeing woman after woman that looked the same as me, you know what I mean? Like, exactly, you know, similar age, similar build, often, you know, same coloured hair, and just knowing that you know, realistically, we're all kind of living in that house of sticks, you know, like this sort of false thing where we, you know, this idea of security, you know, like it really is. And especially, yeah, we really are often just a few paychecks away, you know, like it's incredible.
Yes.
What part, I'm interested in this because I have some views, I've always got views, but...
Yes, I know you do.
You know me well. But I was just wondering what part... Because, I mean, Jeff deals with, you know, like a lot of Jeff's poems are about, you know, Newtown, where there's a lot of people that are living tough and that sort of thing. And I'm just wondering, what part do you think poetry and writing has to play, you know, in the... I mean, New Zealand's in a bad shape, Natasha. It's fucked here. But I just wonder, you know, when things are fucked and, you know, no one seems to care and, you know, the politics is going a dodgy way, what part do you think, if any, do you think that poetry or writing has in that?
Can I just preface my response with my favourite line of poetry by Jeff Cochrane, which is, "Drunk in the Lady Norwood Rose Garden."
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah. Every time I used to walk past the Botanical Garden in Wellington to the Lady Norwood Rose Garden, I'd look for Jeff Cochrane to see if there was a bundle of clothing underneath a bed of roses.
So true. That is, I just think that is such a wonderful mirror, isn't it? Like that idea that in New Zealand we do have that odd shit going on where we have Lady Norwood. And yeah, it's just so odd. Are you drawn to writing about those things? Like why are you not writing about the pretty rose gardens, Natasha?
I don't know. I guess like Jeff Cochrane, I'm attracted to real life and poetry of living and making your way in the world and trying to hang on to some of your ideals and some of the things that you believe in but also, you know, living in the real world of addiction, disease, homelessness, promiscuity, or, you know, the things that happen in the real world. I think, you know, sometimes people think that poetry has to be highfalutin and elevated. But sometimes it's quotidian, you know, it's to do with the everyday life. I guess I'm more attracted to that.
Me too, yeah. I think we're that way inclined. Hey, I think we're nearing an end. Is there anything else you want to say, or do you want to read us another poem maybe? Would you read us another poem?
Yes, but can I read one of Jeff's?
Oh, I'd love that. That would be beautiful.
It's from the Bengal Engine's Mango Afterglow. What a great title that is. Can you hear how those G's are all binging off each other? Bengal Engine, Mango Afterglow. All those G's, soft and hard G's going boom, 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 boom. It's just beautiful.
He really is.
Yeah, and those disyllabic words, Bengal Engine, Mango. After, you know, that it forms a kind of rhythm. It's a wonderful, wonderful phrase.
Oh, he's so genius.
Hey, I want to read Beautiful Rapist.
Oh, yes, please.
Page 26. So, at the age of 10 or 11, he pulls together all there is of him and writes to his absent father. And his father responds with this: "Dear Travis, don't write to me again. I've been trying to forget all about you here in Australia, you and your slut of a mother. I've got a new son now, and he's called Travis too. I named him Travis in order to erase you. Yes, but he is and will remain a pretty boy, and soon he'll learn to coax out of himself his own rigid version of pride, veined and flanged and glossy. A dozen or so transforming years from now, he'll become his own enfolding, lucent shield, a raping angel, suave as any blade, a gorgeous killer armed with a claw hammer. I just love that.
It's a beautiful poem. What do you love about it?
Oh, do you know, I mean, it's very beautifully written. I love the writing, but there's a huge psychodynamic sweep in that poem, you know, about how people are really fucked up by their parents and the giving or the withholding of love, and how it can, you know, have such a deep effect, and how it takes us an entire lifetime to make sense of our childhood. That's all in there too. And also, you know, you would be aware, working in the prison system, you know, that murderers, people that commit violent crimes, you know, the genesis of it is very often in childhood, right?
And it's just, I mean, yet again, it's one of those examples of a poem that just doesn't look away, eh?
Yeah.
Like it sort of says, this is complicated, and it's more complicated than you think it is. And yeah, and now I'm going to throw in the most, you know, emotive of all words, and there you go. And I just, I don't know, like, I just think there is a degree of chutzpah, I don't know if I'm using the word right, but there's a degree of bravery in the work, which, you know, I just think, oh, I just love it when people go there. I like it when people go there. I think it's
I do too. And I think, to my mind, you know, the New Zealand has produced some wonderful poets. It's got, everyone would say that. And I think Jeff Cochrane is up there amongst the best with James K. Baxter and Honey Tufura.
Yeah, I totally agree.
But I don't think that he's that widely appreciated. I don't know. That's the impression that I get.
Yeah.
He's kind of become an acquired taste, I think. I don't know.
It's really interesting because this is my sense, and I don't know if it's like projection, but I feel like in the last couple of years, especially with the release of the collected short stories, there seems to be some momentum growing around him. And I don't know if you know, but he was named an arts foundation sort of laureate last year.
Oh, yes. Which, no, I didn't know that. Yeah. But I'm glad for him because he deserves to be.
Exactly. And I think that there's a momentum surrounding him. And I don't know if that's because I'm looking for it, but it definitely felt like, you know, people used to call him a writer's writer, which seems like some kind of death knell. You know, but I feel like there is, I'm hoping, and I hope that the momentum continues. You know, there was a new book out this year, and I mean, you know, that's what I love about Jeff Cochrane. There's always a new book, you know, it's just so exciting. So what are you doing for the rest of the night?
You know what else is, I think that Fergus Barrowman of Victoria University Press and Damien Wilkins and other people have really fostered and supported Jeff Cochrane and sort of, you know, been behind him. And I think that I'm very pleased. You know, he's one of the few people that, you know, his primary living comes from poetry, I guess. And he's supported, which I think is great.
I think it's so true.
Oh. You know, he's not like Sam Hunt, who can go around and sort of leverage himself into a career from performing and making records, and that, which is all very good too. But I'm pleased that Jeff Cochrane is being promoted and supported by people, and I would be very happy for him if what you said is true. I hope it is, that he's some momentum behind him. But you know, I think he's my age. I think he's maybe 65 now. I don't know, at least 60.
Because I think that's kind of what's interesting as well, is that it feels like it won't, you know, he won't stop. I don't know, like, I'm just so grateful to him for the work that he's put through. Some really, you know, there could have been easier choices made in his life, but instead he's completely dedicated himself to poetry and the fiction, and I feel like New Zealand's a better place for it. I know my life feels better for it, you know, like, I think that it's an incredible gift to continue to live, you know, like, humbly, but to be willing to share the work like that.
Yeah.
It's quite incredible. Hey, thank you, Natasha.
Thank you.